I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words.
Yeah. I'm building a wall. Okay. I'm building a wall.
And by the way, people are going to come through that wall. We're going to have doors in that wall.
And nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively.
Mexico will pay for the wall, but it'll be reimbursed.
Just perfect. I want it to be so beautiful, because maybe someday they're going to call it the Trump Wall. Maybe.
Coming up on the show, Donald Trump today signed an executive order on building a wall along the Mexican border. We'll have reaction to that later in the show. First, though, also on the topic of executive orders, the Trump administration has apparently drafted a plan that could pave the way for the CIA to reopen black sites abroad. These are the overseas prisons that were used to secretly detain and sometimes torture terrorism suspects after the 9/11 attacks. Former President Barack Obama shut them down when he took office. During his campaign, though, Trump promised to bring back torture tactics like waterboarding and more. Joining us to talk about this is Greg Miller. He covers intelligence agencies and terrorism for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said today he doesn't know where this document came from. He said it's not a White House document, but you obtained a copy of it. It's published on your website. Is it credible?
Well, I mean, I think that our understanding is this was a document that was in some circulation among agencies and officials in Washington, at least in the preliminary stages. We believe it's a legitimate document. Now, I'm not sure what Spicer, if his characterization of this is categorical. Is he saying that this is not a White House document because it hasn't been signed yet or because it wasn't drafted by somebody who's working there? I mean, they have not answered whether this came from somewhere in the Trump administration, and we think it did.
Okay, so what would it do? What does it say?
So basically, it reopens the door to putting the agency back in the business of detaining and interrogating terrorism suspects. Now, it doesn't order the agency to do so. It asks for a review on whether it would make sense to do that. But already, I mean, if this order were signed, it would knock aside some of the existing barriers to putting the CIA back in that role.
But isn't there legislation that prevents the CIA from torturing suspects?
Absolutely. So that's why a lot of people think this is a pretty cynical kind of political ploy, that this really is hard to imagine that given all the legislation that's passed and all that we've learned about the CIA program in recent years, that you could ever return to a day where waterboarding or those kinds of methods are used. They are illegal now, and that's clear. But it would not necessarily be illegal to reauthorize the agency to take custody of terrorism suspects and to use some modified interrogation plan.
All right. So I understand also in the document that the phrase war on terror has been replaced with the phrase fight against radical Islam. What does that say to you?
Well, that's interesting because you're right. This is the version that we have has lots of edits in it, and the edits are really interesting and revealing. So there are words that are stricken out and replaced with other things. Trump was always on President Obama's case for refusing to link terrorism to the religion of Islam. And this document takes every opportunity to use the term Islam or Islamist or Islamism. It also deletes a reference to the global war on terror, which was a Bush-era phrase, and substitutes it a term that's framed around the conflict with Islam.
Right. And both President Bush and President Obama took great pains to avoid saying that the United States was in a war against Islam because they both thought that this would actually inflame people in those parts of the world with anti-American sentiments.
Absolutely. A lot of counterterrorism officials I know agree with that and think that you don't want to make a big religious conflict out of a very fringe sort of terrorism problem. So I think that there's a lot of very smart people who would argue that by labeling this, going out of your way to describe this as a problem with Islam is counterproductive.
Now, does this set up a potential conflict with the Defense Department and the new Secretary James Mattis, incoming Secretary James Mattis, who has also disavowed torture? And what does that mean in terms of the CIA, setting up the CIA and the Defense Department in a possible conflict over this?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this creates nothing but headaches for key members of Trump's emerging administration, including Mattis, who has made clear he has no interest in the United States returning to the use of torture, and Mike Pompeo, who's just in his second day on the job at the CIA and trying to settle in with a workforce that's already pretty skeptical of this administration, and now they're going to be reading about a White House plan that envisions them going back into handling terrorism suspects. I mean, it just makes their lives miserable.
Let me play a clip of tape here, a short one, from Pompeo at his Senate confirmation hearings, where he was asked if he would help bring back forms of torture like waterboarding.
Mm-hmm. Senator, absolutely not. Moreover, I can't imagine that I would be asked that by the president-elect or then president.
Okay, so is there a possible conflict between the CIA and the president over this issue?
Well, I mean, so what he's saying there is he can't imagine getting a request to resume the use of waterboarding. So this document doesn't go that far. Pompeo wasn't asked, so we don't really know whether he would answer similarly to a question about, well, do you think the agency strip away waterboarding and all the most extreme methods that the agency used? Would you be willing to, as at the CIA, go back into setting up secret prisons and interrogating prisoners?
So these black sites, though, they were closed as soon as President Obama took office, correct?
They were empty beforehand, and yes, they've been dismantled.
So they would have to really ramp up a whole new operation and build new buildings and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there are obstacles everywhere you look here. I mean, it's hard to imagine what countries, perhaps Russia excluded, who might be inclined to, I say that partly in jest, might be willing to let the CIA come in and build a secret prison in their borders. I mean, the countries that did so 15 years ago paid a substantial price. I mean, price to their reputations. They were condemned internationally for their complicity in this program.
And let's talk about what this means for Guantanamo Bay. President Obama wanted to shut it down. He never did, but he didn't add any more prisoners to it once he took office.
Right. This takes things in another direction. So this document envisions the resumption of bringing new prisoners to Guantanamo Bay, which has not happened in years. So that if this document were put into effect, it could lead to a growing prison population at Guantanamo, quite the opposite of what Obama spent 8 years trying to accomplish.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That's Greg Miller. He covers intelligence agencies and terrorism for The Washington Post. Well, changes are also on the way for government scientists. At exactly noon on the day of President Trump's inauguration, the climate change-related pages on the White House website disappeared. Since then, the Trump administration has reportedly placed a gag order on scientists and other employees at the EPA and placed a freeze on all the agency's contracts and grants. I spoke with Zoe Schlanger, environment reporter for Quartz Media, earlier today about this. So what do we know about this gag order? Is it just the EPA? And what does it mean, a gag order?
Well, the news is moving really quickly. What initially happened was that the EPA employees got a memo from higher up saying that they should no longer release press releases or tweet or essentially talk to the public at all. Now it appears they may be rolling that back a little bit. The same thing is happening at the Department of Agriculture. There was a similar stop order on releasing science, and they do a lot of research science on agriculture. And suddenly, after tons of news reports came out, another memo leaked saying, let's roll that back. Feel free to proceed.
Oh.
So it's all over the map right now, and it's moving fast.
And initially, was it everything or just news and information related to climate change?
It seemed to be everything. It seems that the EPA is in a huge moment of flux right now, transitioning over to the new administration and scrubbing certain links to climate change off their website. But the gag order, as people are calling it, which maybe a preferable term is a media blackout since it's not a court order, but the media blackout applied to everything.
Is this normal when there's a new administration and it wants to get a consistent, uniform message out there and it needs time to do that?
You know, it's hard to say. The EPA is positing that this is just a short, normal pause, But I think the degree to which we're seeing EPA employees leaking information and otherwise expressing to press anonymously that they're extremely unhappy and scared is suggesting otherwise. I know ProPublica got a quote from an EPA person who said they had not seen something like this in their 10 years in office. It's hard to tell what's normal and what's extreme in this moment.
And then yesterday there was this interesting moment on Twitter with the Badlands National Park, mm-hmm. tweeting out climate-related tweets, which were then removed.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Badlands tweeted, I think, 3 or 4 tweets of just climate science, things like how much CO2 concentration is in the atmosphere. And people immediately glommed onto that as a resistance to the Trump administration, which has been pretty much anti-climate science so far. And then suddenly those all evaporated. They were just deleted. And now we have a kind of interesting development. There's a new Twitter handle that's positing to be tweets from anonymous Park Service employees saying, calling themselves the unofficial resistance team of the U.S. National Park Service.
And what's their Twitter handle?
It's Alt-US Nat Park Service, which is a mouthful.
All right. You wrote a story recently that there are these things called data rescue events. There was one recently here at UCLA. What are they and who's doing them?
So these are a bunch of events that have popped up at about now like 6 universities across the country, I believe, where librarians and archivists and programmers and scientists are all coming together and trying to download as much government data related to the environment and climate change and science as possible. There is a big fear in agencies right now that some science that's relevant to climate change or human health could be taken offline. And that would mean that tons and tons of researchers who are not government employees will not have access to data that they use for their scientific research, let alone the public. So these groups are concerned about that, and they have set up an alternative repository for data called datarefuge.org, and they're doing everything they can to scrape all the pages and put them on this other site.
Does it take a long time to do that?
So I went to one of these in Philly at Penn, actually, and I am not a computer science person, but it took a shockingly short amount of time. Someone downloaded 1.5 terabytes of data in a couple hours. A lot of this is just raw data, so it's just text files almost. So it actually happens pretty quickly, but they have to design very interesting programs off the cuff to figure out how to scrape it.
Well, have there been any directives or anything from the new administration that they need to not do that, or they need to purge the data at the existing sites, or are they just doing this just in case?
Well, initially they were just doing it just in case, thinking about Canada under Stephen Harper as a model where there was restrictions on science. But now it seems their fears are more or less confirmed. The EPA... there was a memo to the EPA to scrub climate change links off their website and to take down their main climate change page. And in the last day, there's been 1 million news reports about this, and a second memo has come out saying, whoa, back off, we'll stand down for now, and now it'll go through a legal review to see what the implications of taking that page down are. But initially, there was a directive to scrub the page of climate change.
And meanwhile, the contracts the EPA hands out, those are frozen for the time being?
They are. And so the EPA awards tons of grants to research scientists and contracts out tons of jobs like cleaning up chemical spills or monitoring groundwater. A lot of these things are done by contract companies, and those have all been frozen as far as anyone can tell. I did just get a release from an EPA person just now saying that they hope to finish their review. They're calling it a review of these contracts by Friday. So hopefully they say the contracts will be reinstated by then.
And again, these are grants that cover all kinds of things, not just climate change related activities.
No, these are grants across the board for sure. I mean, the EPA funds environmental health science and ecology and things like that too.
And what about the people who have been working at these agencies for a while, and let's say they've been working on climate change research or any kind of climate change policy? What's going to happen to them?
You know, it's not clear. I believe in some of the hearings with the appointees, there was questions about that, and all of them said that there would not be, you know, going after anyone who's worked on climate change in the agencies or anything like that. But reports from these various leaks that are happening are suggesting that people are nervous. I did speak to a NASA engineer today who works on a climate change program, and that person felt very nervous that their work was in jeopardy. So it feels like a mostly an atmosphere of not really knowing what's going to happen next.
Zoe Schlanger, environment reporter for Quartz Media. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, California State Senate Leader Kevin DeLeon is here to react to President Trump's executive order today on building a wall with Mexico and on punishing sanctuary cities, cities like Los Angeles. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Donald Trump signed an executive order that orders federal workers to start building the 2,000-mile border wall between the United States and Mexico. He also signed an order to cut federal funding for sanctuary cities, cities like Los Angeles. Here is President Trump just moments ago at the Department of Homeland Security.
Our order also does the following: ends the policy of catch and release at the border. Requires other countries to take back their criminals. They will take them back. Cracks down on sanctuary cities. Empowers ICE officers to target and remove those who pose a threat to public safety. Calls for the hiring of another 5,000 Border Patrol officers. Calls for the tripling the number of ICE officers.
Trump is expected to take more action on immigration, including slashing the number of refugees entering the United States later this week. Kevin DeLeon is president pro tem of the California State Senate. He represents the 24th district, which includes downtown Los Angeles. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Madeline. How are you doing?
I am great, thanks. Well, let's begin with the wall first. Does the president need the cooperation of California to build the wall where it is in California, or can he go around you?
Well, let me say this. It should go without saying that America is and always been a nation of immigrants. The executive actions announced today are counterproductive, they're divisive, and they're unnecessary. We're at an all-time low when it comes to immigration to the United States. So the question is, why build a wall? And I believe that he's continuously, you know, he's been continuously stoking the fears of racism, because building a wall won't make us safer, and they won't bring back jobs or solve our economic challenges. We do have a team of folks exploring, you know, what are the environmental consequences of building a wall with our friend, with our business partner south of the border with California. And again, he just continues to divide the country.
So does that mean that you would look into filing a lawsuit against building the wall?
Well, I'm not going to go there right now, but we're looking at what the environmental damage may possibly be by building a huge wall on our southern border with our neighbor Mexico.
What about what he just mentioned? This order empowers ICE officers to remove people considered a threat to public safety. How do you interpret that?
Well, obviously, the federal government has every legal authority to detain and deport anyone who's undocumented, anyone who, quote unquote, is illegal in the United States. That is their federal purview. But the California state government and local governments don't have to cooperate or collaborate with Donald J. Trump and with the ICE agents. Quite frankly, I don't believe that cities like Los Angeles, San Jose, in San Francisco and others are going to be assisting ICE agents staking out an elementary school, waiting for mothers to pick up their children after school. That's not what California is about.
Right. Well, he did say just those that represent a threat to public safety.
Well, the question is this. What is the threat to public safety? Because about a month ago, he had made the assessment that there were close to 3 million criminal felons in the United States of America. We don't know where that number came up. We know it's another alternative fact. We don't know if he loosens up the criteria, and all of a sudden that's the nanny who's working on the west side in Santa Monica, or that's the busboy, you know, who's picking up plates, you know, in a restaurant in Brentwood or Pacific Palisades. So no one argues that if you're a violent criminal, a murderer, or a violent gang member, that you should not be in our community. I would argue that we don't want anyone like that, whether you're Mexican, Canadian, Irish, or Chinese, or even American, you know. But how he's playing with statistics and how he is redefining what a criminal immigrant is most disconcerting to us, and we're not going to do his job for him.
Well, he has said that if you don't, he will cut federal grants to sanctuary cities.
Well, let me say this, is that we believe strongly, and that's why we hired the law firm of Covington, headed up by the former Attorney General of the U.S., Eric Holder, that that would be illegal, that he would actually threaten the city of Los Angeles and the people of Los Angeles and other cities throughout California. If you don't cooperate with us, we're going to take away money from you, or we're not going to give you any federal dollars. Let me be very clear about something. California is a donor state. Therefore, we get less of our tax dollars than we actually contribute to the federal government. We believe that it is illegal and it's unconstitutional if, in fact, he does withhold any federal grants, dollars that help our community members, whether it's senior citizen centers, was young children who are after school programs. He's hurting Californians. And if you're hurting Californians and you undermine the California economy, you're actually undermining the economy of the United States of America. We're not going to give in to these verbal threats by Donald J. Trump.
Well, this is actually an executive order. So given that this is an official document, does that mean that now sets the wheel in motion for a lawsuit on your part?
Well, you know, the executive order is obviously his purview. Ultimately, if they're going to withhold any dollars, necessary dollars needed for California, it will require an act of Congress, to be very clear, and to give us the notice and the terms of those federal grants that may be imposed upon with their conditions. That being said, it may invite us to be in a court of law. That's why we're actually making, we're trying to be judicious about this. We're trying to be politically mature about this, and we're making an objective assessment if, in fact, we have to go to a court of law to prevent the president from withholding any necessary federal dollars that we need for our quality of life in California.
Does fighting him on this and other issues like the environment and healthcare, things like that, does fighting him on those issues imperil cooperation with other projects, projects the governor holds dear, infrastructure projects, for example? He mentioned yesterday in his State of the State address that he would love to work with the Trump administration on building up California's infrastructure.
Well, I'll say this, Madeline, and I've always been very clear from day one. As a Democrat and as a leader of the Senate, it's my role and responsibility to do everything within my power to protect the people, the values, and the policies of the great state of California. Now, as a Democrat, you know, when a Republican wins, naturally I feel a sense of disappointment, but we move forward. Whether it was John McCain or Mitt Romney or any other Republican candidate, we'd move forward and try to move together as a nation and find common ground. This is very different. This is an individual from day one who has attempted to undermine through rhetoric the values and the policies and the people of California. He's doubled down on his cabinet secretaries, and he has confirmed our worst fears. So when it comes to science, in terms of climate change and the air that we breathe in California, especially in Southern California, we want clean air. We don't want dirty air. We don't want to go backwards. We want to move forward. When it comes to protecting families, mothers, you know, and their children, children and their mothers, these are the values of the people of California. It's, you know, to do a carrot and a stick sort of scenario with the president. We'll work with him when we can work with him, no doubt. But when he threatens and undermines economic prosperity and the people of California, we have no other choice but to defend the people of California.
Kevin DeLeon, leader of the California State Senate, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
And we want to hear from immigrants living in Southern California. Tell us what you're thinking about during these first few days of the Trump presidency. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or share your thoughts on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, actor Alan Cumming is here. He starred in the musical Cabaret. Now he has his own cabaret show.
I've always found it really strange that people talk like me or talk with an English accent, and then suddenly when they start singing, they're like, oh, I'm an American now. And it's just, I don't understand it.
Alan Cumming, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. He has played Hamlet. He's played a Smurf. He's made films with Stanley Kubrick and the Spice Girls. He has sung at Carnegie Hall, and he has sung a jingle for Trojan condoms. This Sunday, Alan Cumming is at Disney Hall with his show. Alan Cumming sings sappy songs. But before that, he's here with us on Press Play. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Alan Cumming sings sappy songs. It's an old-fashioned cabaret show. Aside from starring in the musical Cabaret, had you ever done Cabaret before?
Yes, this is the second show I've done. I did one about 5 or 6 years ago called I Bought a Blue Car Today, but I didn't tour it in nearly as big a way as I'm doing this one. It was sort of about me becoming an American citizen, and that was the first one I'd ever done, and I was, you know, really terrified to do it. And it was funny because I'd always wanted to do a show like this, and I got asked by the Lincoln Center to do one of their American Songbook things. Mm-hmm. In New York. And so I said, okay, I'll bite the bullet and I'll do it, because they kind of, like, you know, help you get an arranged musical director. And so the whole thing was kind of made much more easy. So I did that. And whilst I was preparing for that, people at the Sydney Mardi Gras Festival heard that I was going to be doing a show and asked if I'd like to come and do that, take it there. So my first foray into being a cabaret artist were at the Lincoln Center and the Sydney Opera House.
Wow.
I started small.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, I really enjoyed doing that show, and I think it made me realize how much that connection with an audience is possible doing a cabaret show like that, and how much I liked it. And then I kind of did it for a bit, and then I made up this show for the Cafe Carlyle in New York a year and a half ago, and I really feel I'm much, much better now than I was. Apologies to everyone who saw the last show. It was fine, but I'm better now.
But this is better. Why is it better?
I think because it's more, I'm more... able to be vulnerable, I think. I think that's what it is. I think that's also something about growing older and just, you know, and also I wrote my book. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book that was talking a lot about my father and my family, and I feel like I've put stuff out into the world that is very open and authentic and vulnerable, and so it makes it easier for me to stand up in a room and sing songs that are very emotional. And because of that book, I think it's a big part of my life suddenly was available to the public that hadn't been in the past, and that kind of loosened things up for me a bit.
So this is a book about coming to terms with your father, who was abusive physically and psychologically with you, and who claimed that he wasn't your father.
Yeah.
And then you had to find out if in fact he was your father, which was itself its own form of psychological abuse, to put it
mildly. You never think you'll do a DNA test to find out if you're actually your father's son, but hey-ho, life.
Yeah.
Slings and arrows at you.
So I want to play a song of you, because we have a recording of the songs that you're going to be singing at Disney Concert Hall. And this is one. It's a Rufus Wainwright song. It's called Dinner at 8.
This is the song I sing, actually, after I talk about my dad in the show, because this is a song that Rufus wrote about his dad, and I've always loved it.
No matter how strong, I'm going to take you down with one little stone. I'm gonna break you down and see what you're worth, what you're really worth to me.
This song is about him kind of taking down his father, but also realizing for himself what his father really means to him. So the circumstances are very different for me, but an idea of taking someone down and I'm going to break you down and see what you're really worth. I mean, that's amazing. And it's a really difficult song to sing. I cry every time I sing it. I've sung it hundreds of times now.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Alan Cumming about his cabaret show this Sunday at Disney Hall. It's called Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. And so it's not all really heavy emotional songs that you're singing about your relationship with your father. There's also, you're doing that Trojan condom ad song. It's called Ecstasy.
I know it sounds crazy, but I kind of put it in the show as a sort of, you know, to lighten things up.
With ecstasy, no STDs. Feels like nothing between you and me. Let's slosh around and we will see the fun that rises with ecstasy. We will be flirty and dirty as we can be. It's the safest way to learn about the birds and bees with no surprises.
It came to me one day. I literally got this phone call saying, "Hey, Alan, would you like to make a condom commercial for the internet?" And so I was like, "Tell me more." I got to do whatever I liked, and I made this 1950s musical condom commercial set in a talk show. And I'm a talk show host, and Ricky's the star that's on my sofa. And so Lance, my musical director, and I wrote the little song that is Ecstasy. And what was funny, when I played Carnegie Hall, I had some guests, and I got Ricky Lake to come. We flew her in to sing it, and it's like a 75-second song. So I thought, gosh, she's come all this way. Let's just sing it again. So I just sang it totally two times in a row.
Is she going to be there on Sunday?
What a good idea. I'm going to call her right now.
Okay, well, not right now because we're not done talking. But maybe after we're done talking. So you're singing in your own Scottish accent. And, you know, a lot of performers from the British Isles, they try to use a kind of a generic accent or an American accent to sing pop songs.
Yeah.
Was this a conscious decision on your part to stick with your own accent, or is it just you couldn't do it?
No, it definitely was. I mean, I feel it's an interesting thing. I've always found it really strange that people talk like me or talk, you know, like with an English accent, and then suddenly when they start singing, they're like, "Oh, I'm an American now," and it's just, I don't understand it. I do understand it. I think, you know, pop music or rock music is a kind of an American idiom, you know, it's an American form initially, and so people associate the Americana with, I mean, you know, I love, like when you think of Adele, I love her so much, and what a stunning voice, but when she speaks, she's this little Cockney girl, and then she sounds like she sounds, this beautiful thing. So for me, there's a kind of disconnect between that. Much as I love her, I just feel like it's sort of, to sing as me, I just felt I had to sing in my own voice, and I love the way my voice sounds singing. I mean, I actually really like my accent, and I've played, you know, you talked about Hamlet and Macbeth, both those roles, I use my own Scottish voice, and Shakespeare is really great for a Scottish accent, so it's really guttural. And
Well, how could you do Macbeth in any other accent? I mean, he is the Scottish king.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Yeah. No, most, I mean, you know, it's funny when people in England do it with an English accent, you know, and I think, you know, people should do Shakespeare with whatever accent they are from, because, like, you know, yeah. You play Hamlet. He's from Denmark. Nobody does it in a Danish accent. Or India. But people, you know, people here in America, I feel, have got a kind of an inferiority complex about Shakespeare. And they always do a kind of funny half-English voice when they do it. And I think it sounds stupid. And they should just do it in an American accent. It would be much, much better. It would sound better. And also, I think they would find that the language suits their voices better than they imagine. But anyway, back to me and my show. Many, many years ago, actually, when I was doing Macbeth, I've done Macbeth a couple of times. I was like 20 years old, and I got let off drama school for a term to play Malcolm in Macbeth at the Tron Theatre in Glasgow. This is in the mid-80s. And I was going through the bar to go into the dressing room one evening, and there were these specky boys sitting there. I remember going into the dressing room and said, "Who are those geeks with the specs?" And I said, "Oh, they're the band. They're playing in the bar after the show." And it was the Proclaimers. And I went back out, and they, you know, they sang with their own voices in a very rich Fife accent, a really kind of intense Scottish accent. And I was blown away by it. I'd never heard anyone sing kind of, you know, pop songs with a Scottish accent. And I loved them, and I just found them such an influence in terms of me finding my own voice as a singer.
You are an American, right? You have, or at least you have U.S. citizenship.
Yes, I'm a joint citizen of Europe and America.
Mm-hmm. But you were very active in terms of calling for Scottish independence.
Absolutely.
And so is that also part of it? I know that you like to sing in your own Scottish accent, but it's also a way of sort of a political statement.
Well, I guess it is a political statement because I'm saying I am very proud of who I am, and I feel that my voice is good enough and my voice should be heard. So, yes, I think those are parallel. There's great parallels to the Scottish independence movement there that, you know, our voice is not heard. It's not been heard for a long, long time, and it's continuing not to be heard. What the Scottish people want is not what the Scottish people get. I think the values that we have as Scottish people are just different to the rest of Britain, especially to England, and I think we're not going to be able to implement those values if we continue to be ruled by a government that doesn't let us do what we want.
So how do you feel about what's happening here then in the United
terrified.
States?
Terrified, absolutely terrified. I mean, I think it's a really terrifying time because we are going backwards in many, many ways in terms of this anti-intellectualism and this idea of how misogyny, racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, all being acceptable and normalized. And, you know, I think we've got to just not normalize what is happening here and be vigilant. Vigilant is my word of the year. I've got it under my signature and my email just to remind me every single time I see an email. But I'm actually really nervous. I'm an immigrant in this country. I am a queer person. Many of Donald Trump's supporters would consider me degenerate. And I recently did a project about Max Beckmann, the painter from Germany, who had to leave Germany because he was labeled a degenerate artist. He was, you know, a white, straight man, yet he had to leave his country in the 30s. So it's not too much of a ridiculous kind of histrionic thing for me to believe that I might be encouraged to leave this country because of who I am in the next couple of years if we keep going in the direction we're going in.
Well, it's interesting that you were in cabaret for so long, and it's very similar.
Absolutely. You know, that's why I really wish I was doing cabaret again. I mean, I did it. I went back to doing it about 2 years ago now. Then it was all about the Olympics and Russia and how gay people have been treated in Russia and all these other kind of things. And that's why it's a great show, because its message is still incredibly potent, sadly, which is that we've got to, you know, embrace people who are different from us. Not be afraid of them, embrace them, and just realize that we are all the same. But at the same time, be completely vigilant about the slide into extremism that can easily happen if we look away. And that's what happened in Germany. So, you know, look out, America.
So I wonder. I'm looking at the title of your show, Alan Cummings Sings Sappy Songs. Does that fit now, that title, given what you've just said and the seriousness of our cultural moment?
I mean, yes, because that's what I'm doing. I mean, I'm singing sappy songs. I'm singing songs that are sappy in that they are emotional and they have an emotional connection. And I use that title to not only sort of warn the audience that it's going to be, you know, emotional and quite intense, but also it's got humor because I'm saying I'm going to sing some sappy songs. But I definitely feel that my next show, which is actually, I think, going to be based on the project that I did about Max Beckmann, and I'm really intrigued by this way that, you know, in the 30s, all the artists that the show Cabaret was about, these clubs and like Friedrich Holländer and all these amazing people who were great protest artists. They were singers and satirists. And they really were the first people to shout out and to say, watch out, everybody. And of course, they were the first people to be shut down when Hitler came to power. And I'm really intrigued about doing a show where I can sing those songs, but also sing contemporary songs at the same time and, you know, build a show. And I talk about me being an immigrant, and I think as an immigrant, this idea of the other being scary and being people we should block is a really terrifying one. And I think that's something I definitely want to explore in terms of, you know, doing a cabaret show about what it feels like to be an outsider, because I feel like an outsider in my own country now too, because I've spent so much time here. But I think that's what it's going to be. You know, Alan Cumming, legal immigrant.
Well, Alan Cumming, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's been lovely. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Alan Cumming. He's at Disney Hall this Sunday, the 29th, performing his show, Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. Coming up on this program, we are going to remember the woman who turned the world on with her smile, Mary Tyler Moore, who died today at the age of 80. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
How will you make it on your own? This world is awfully big. Girl, this time you're all alone. But it's time you...
Theme song from the iconic Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mary Tyler Moore died today. She was 80 years old. She began her career wanting to be a dancer. Her first big break was as a dancing kitchen appliance in commercials. And here to help us remember more about Mary Tyler Moore and her long career is Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for Uproxx. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, on TV, her first big break was when she was cast as Laura Petrie on the Dick Van Dyke Show in the 1960s. Tell us a bit about that show and her role in it.
So the Dick Van Dyke Show was created by Carl Reiner. It was sort of inspired by his experience as a writer for Sid Caesar on Your Show of Shows. And it starred Dick Van Dyke as a fictionalized version of Reiner and Mary Tyler Moore as his wife, Laura Petrie. And they were kind of, they were TV's first yuppies. They were basically like a sitcom version of JFK and Jackie in terms of sort of dashing and new and exciting. And they were so sexy that, like, the network had to have them sleep in separate beds to avoid, like, upsetting the sponsors. But, you know, just the sight of Mary Tyler Moore in those capri pants dancing around in front of party guests was enough right there to sort of set a lot of imaginations on fire.
And that was a big deal, right, that she wore the pants instead of a dress?
It was huge. It was a fashion trendsetter. Suddenly, like, capri pants went from a fashion afterthought to an essential accessory.
So she won a couple of Emmys on that show, right? And then she began, she started the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which is what she's most famous for, obviously. And that was in the 1970s. And she created that with her husband, Grant Tinker.
Well, she and Grant Tinker created a production company called MTM Enterprises, mm-hmm. which was responsible not only for the Mary Tyler Moore Show and all of its many spinoffs, but also for the Bob Newhart Show and the White Shadow and WKRP in Cincinnati and Hill Street Blues in St. Elsewhere.
Wow.
So, like, basically, you know, there was Lucille Ball who did I Love Lucy and started a production company that gave us Star Trek and lots of other things. And then Mary Tyler Moore followed suit. So she's most famous for this sitcom that bore her name, but she was also just a giant as a producer and as someone who found all this talent. You know, one of her first shows she did after the Mary Tyler Moore Show ended was a variety sketch show called Mary, and two of the members of the ensemble were young, unknown Michael Keaton and David Letterman.
Incredible. So she really was a cultural force on and off the screen.
She was, and that's, I mean, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was just hugely important. Not just, it was a great comedy, and I never want that to be overlooked in talking about its social import, but the idea of a show about a single woman who is focused primarily on her career, secondarily on her friendships, and then as a very, very distant third on actually looking for romance. This was such a huge break from convention and so influential, not only on shows that followed, but just on people who watched it. And I've heard over the years from so many women who said that they went into the news business because of Mary Richards, that character.
All right, let's play a clip from the show since we've been talking about it, and let's listen.
Okay, here's the editing schedule through Friday, and here's a list of the sponsors. It's worth checking to see which news item comes before which commercial. Otherwise, it can be a little embarrassing.
Yeah, like when Ted read that item about the raid on the massage parlors, followed by the commercial about letting your fingers do the walking.
Right.
So talk a little bit about her and her character. She always seemed to be having to push back against these preening male egos.
Yeah, there was always this assumption, you know, that she was a pushover, and she wasn't. You know, the very first scene she has with the Lou Grant character played by Ed Asner, there's the famous moment at the end where he says, you know, you've got spunk, and she thinks that's a compliment, and he says, I hate spunk. But, like, he grew to love her, Ted Baxter grew to love her, Maurice Slaughter, every character on that show who was, for one reason or another, distrustful or dismissive of her, all came to basically be in awe of her because that's how wonderful she was.
All right. And then she also made movies, and probably most famously the film Ordinary People, where she played the cold mother in that film. And let's play a clip from that.
Mothers don't hate their sons. Is that what he told you? Do you see how you accept what he says with no questions and you can't do the same thing
for me, can
you?
I'm just trying to keep this family
together.
God,
I don't know what anyone wants from me anymore.
Beth, nobody wants anything from me.
Listen, look. We all just want Cal, Connor, everybody. We just want you to be happy.
happy?
Yes.
Ward, you tell me the definition of happy, huh? But first you better make sure that your kids are good and safe. That no one's fallen off a horse, or been hit by a car, or drowned in that swimming pool you're so proud of.
Oh, yeah.
And then you come to me and tell me how to be happy.
Mary Tyler Moore and Donald Sutherland in the movie Ordinary People. And Alan, that is a very different character than the one she played on The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
And I think that's part of why it's so effective, is because you hire America's sweetheart, the woman who could turn the world on with her smile, and you cast her as this cold and controlling matriarch who doesn't want to let her emotions out. And it's a great performance beyond that, but so much of it just builds on the fact that, like, we're dealing with Mary Tyler Moore in this context.
Mm-hmm. Right, and her strained relationship with her son. And in real life, she had a tragedy with her son. Her son killed himself inadvertently, apparently, but had shot himself, her only son.
She dealt with a lot of difficulties. She was diagnosed with diabetes in her 30s, wound up raising tons of money as the head of Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundations, and, you know, had apparently been sick for quite a while before she passed away today.
And what was she known for in her later years? Was she able to keep producing and acting?
She kept acting. She kept working. I think her last appearance was she did a couple of episodes of Hot in Cleveland, you know, as a Mary Tyler Moore Show reunion with Betty White a few years back. She never stopped working, but there was certainly, it's hard for anyone to have more than one iconic show, and she had two, mm-hmm. which almost nobody does. Even if, like, people have multiple hits, they're never quite as impactful as Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore Show were combined. And so even though she kept doing other shows, the shadows of Laura Petrie and Mary Richards were very long and kind of hard for her to escape. But she kept going and she kept producing, and, you know, and then eventually in the aughts, she did reunion movies with both Mary and Rhoda, and then the Dick Van Dyke Show Revisited, I think it was called.
And did she embrace her role as a feminist icon?
Absolutely. You know, she gave speeches about it. You know, even behind the scenes on the show, it was such a big deal that they had to hire lots of women writers. Sitcoms were not really the province of women at the time. They weren't allowed in the room. And Mary and James L. Brooks and Alan Burns all said, no, we've got to have women writing, not only just to sort of better reflect what Mary and Rhoda and the others are concerned with, but just it would be phony and dumb to have a show about a woman struggling for respect in a male-dominated workplace to not make their own workplace more welcoming to women.
Right, right. So it is, I haven't watched those shows in a long time, but it would definitely be worth going back to watch
those
shows.
If you can find, there's an episode called Chuckles Bites the Dust, where Chuckles the Clown from the local station dies tragically because he's wearing a peanut costume and a circus elephant tries to shell him. And Mary and the gang go to Chuckles' funeral and have a very hard time not laughing at the funeral. It is one of the great sitcom episodes, and especially sitcom scenes ever made, and it doesn't matter that it's, you know, 40 plus years old. It's perfect.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for helping us remember Mary Tyler Moore.
My pleasure.
That's Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for Up Rocks, and we were remembering Mary Tyler Moore. She died today. She was 80 years old.
You can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it. Love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have a town.
Oh, Jolie's theme. Not the Mary Tyler Moore theme, but Jolie's theme.
Slightly less
slightly
good,
different.
Say, yeah.
Not exactly
have
giving me the chills like the other one did.
I know. But I had a smile on my face that was almost as big as Mary Tyler Moore's.
and you don't have a beret, but anyway.
Not that
to,
you know of.
To fix.
Yeah. In honor of Mary Tyler Moore, I declare tomorrow National Beret Day.
Thank you.
Someone of our listeners posted a quote from Mary Tyler Moore on our Twitter feed. She said, "Take chances, make mistakes. That's how you grow. Pain nourishes your courage. You have to fail in order to practice being brave." Wonderful sentiment from Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah.
Died at the age of 80 today. Other listeners expressed their sadness at her death. John G. Hill says this is painfully symbolic. The woman who portrayed the role model for smart, independent women could no longer survive in this day and age. Barb Tone just wanted to quote the song, "Who can take nothing, take a nothing day and suddenly make it seem worthwhile?" And Kelly Henderson points out that she's called America's sweetheart, but in this day and age, we should be calling her America's badass woman, which I think is a good update on that. I recently watched a couple episodes of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I have to tell you, as a news producer, man, not a lot has changed. Besides having
there are
to,
a few more women in the newsroom.
I was going to say, I don't have to deal with a bunch of male personalities as hosts, Madeline.
Well, sometimes I have a male personality. I'm just saying.
Okay. You're going to make it after all. We're all going to make it after all.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers. And thank you so much for weighing in. And please continue to do so on our Facebook page and our Twitter page at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.